Hello, this is William Fink, and this is Chris Degenia Internet Radio. Today is Friday, August 21st, 2026. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. This evening, we're going to present highlights in Exodus, and this is subtitled The Confrontation. It will discuss mostly Exodus chapters 4 through the middle of chapter 7. We won't quite get into the plagues of Egypt. That'll be next. There's several things I want to discuss there. In Exodus chapter 3, Moses had received his appointment from the angel in the burning bush. Notice that while the apparition of the burning in the bush was called the angel of Yahweh, in verse 2 of the chapter, Yahweh himself is characterized as having done all of the speaking. And this should broaden our concept of the use of the word angel. The corresponding Hebrew and Greek words simply mean messenger. While an angel may be a man, and it may be a supernatural entity or being, person, if you will, it may also be anything which Yahweh God wants to utilize in order to send a message to men. So the burning in the bush was an angel, a messenger, insofar as it was a physical apparition by which Yahweh had gotten the attention of Moses so that he may speak to him. Since Yahweh God himself is invisible to men, basically, any physical apparition representing his presence is an angel, such as the pillars of smoke and fire, which shall be manifest later in this Exodus account. This changes with the advent of Yahshua Christ, whom Paul of Tarsus had described as the image of the person of Yahweh in the opening verses of his epistle to the Hebrews. With that event at the burning bush, we also learned from the ensuing dialogue why it is that Moses had called him Yahweh. Since when he asked God what he should be called, he was told in verse 14 of that chapter that I am what I am that I am. And he said, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am has sent me unto you. Here we explain that the phrase which translates as I am is ahaya, which is the Hebrew word haya, a verb which means to be, prefixed with the letter aleph, so that it becomes a first-person verb meaning I am. So Moses, from his perspective, understood the name given by God to mean he is, from Moses' perspective, from Yahweh's perspective, it's I am. Moses can't go to the children of Israel and say, I am. He can't do that. They'll think that he's saying that he is God. So Moses correctly amended that verb to he is. And in proper Hebrew grammar, the aleph is replaced with an iota, by which the verb is converted to the third person, and the spelling is Yod-Heh-Vau-Heh, or in the alternate spelling of the verb, Yah-Heh-Yah-Heh. So we have to bear that in mind, and I will discuss that momentarily. Yah-Heh-Vau-Heh may be pronounced Yahweh, or perhaps Yahavah or Jehovah, as we shall discuss. While we shall never really know how the verbs were enunciated in ancient Hebrew, the oldest testimony is that of Flavius Josephus, who had said in Book 5 of his Wars of the Judeans that the name of God consists of four vowels. Since Josephus was writing in Greek, he must have meant four Greek vowels. And we can pronounce the name Yahweh with four Greek vowels, but that does not work for Yahweh or Jehovah. Not at all. So Yahweh God does not truly have a name, as humans perceive that men and entities have names. Rather, he only called himself I Am, and had evidently wanted his people Israel to acknowledge that when they called upon him, proclaiming that he is. Among other places in Scripture, this is also evident in the Messianic prophecy in Isaiah chapter 52. Therefore, my people shall know my name. Therefore, they shall know in that day that I am he that does speak. Behold, it is I. Then in verse 7, this is connected to the gospel of Christ. How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that brings good tidings. The word gospel means good tidings or a good message in archaic English. That publishes peace, that brings good tidings of good, that publishes salvation, that saith unto Zion, thy God reigneth. Christ is king. Thy God reigneth. Later in John chapter 8, Christ declared to his adversaries that he was the fulfillment of this prophecy, where we read, then said Jesus unto them, King James Version, when you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you shall know that I am he, and that I do nothing of myself, but as my Father has taught me, I speak these things, and he that sent me is with me. The Father has not left me alone, for I do always those things that please him. In that phrase, I am he in verse 28, the pronoun he is added, and the Christogenia New Testament has the passage to read, then Yahshua said, when you raise up the Son of Man, then you shall know that I am, and I do nothing by myself, but just as the Father has taught me, these things I say. And he who has sent me is with me. He has not left me alone, because I always do the things which please him. Yahweh had declared many times in Isaiah that I am, or that he is from our perspective, and especially in the final 26 chapters, relating to the many promises of salvation for Israel. So it is natural that Christ would later make the same declaration concerning himself, informing us that he is the Savior of the promises and prophecies of Isaiah. So in Isaiah chapter 44, we read, thus saith Yahweh, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, Yahweh of hosts, I am the first and I am the last, and besides me there is no God. And then in the words of Christ, in reference to himself, in Revelation chapter 22, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last. So once again, Christ is Yahweh. Christ is the image of the person of God who spoke that of himself in both places. Now moving on from where we had left off at Exodus chapter 3. Yahweh had given Moses his appointment, but also warned that the king of Egypt would not let the people go casually, so that Yahweh would have to smite Egypt before the people could go. Moses seems to have accepted the appointment, but as chapter 4 opens, he expresses many reservations and concerns. And he even ventures to beg for a replacement. In the opening verses of Exodus chapter 4, Moses had doubted that the people would believe him. But Yahweh gave him a sign, changing his staff into a serpent as an indication that he would make the people believe Moses. Later, the Egyptian magicians are portrayed as having been able to perform a similar miracle, something which is beyond our current understanding. However, Yahweh also prevailed in their eyes, employing the staff of Aaron. That's about where we're going to end this presentation this evening. Doing that, Yahweh also demonstrated to Moses that he could make a man a leper and restore him again, something which later happened to Miriam, Moses' own sister. Then Yahweh showed Moses that he can turn blood, water to blood. Having observed these things as a demonstration at this early time, it is apparent that the experience may have comforted and strengthened Moses when he saw them on a much larger scale in the events which followed. But Moses also doubted himself, as we read in Exodus chapter 4 and verse 10. And Moses said unto Yahweh, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither heretofore, nor since thou hast spoken unto thy servant, but I am slow of speech and of a slow tongue. That right there proves that Moses wasn't a Jew. A Jew would be a fast talker and have the gift of gab, as they like to brag. Okay, I'm kidding. Sort of. Moses, a man educated in the house of a king, was not necessarily eloquent, as education alone does not endow a man with speaking ability. We can observe in politics today that many educated men do not necessarily speak well. Some actually bumble, and many empty suits can talk their way into high offices. Men who are evidently of the class of the brambles, of the parables, of the trees of the forest. So once again, Yahweh reassured Moses. However, Moses kindled the wrath of God, where he continued to doubt and said, according to the King James Version in verse 13, O my Lord, send, I pray thee, by the hand of him whom thou wilt send. This translation seems to obscure the plain meaning of the passage, and it is interpreted in the Septuagint to read, And Moses said, I pray thee, Lord, appoint another able person whom thou shalt send. Only about a third of the book of Exodus survived in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And this section of chapter 4 is not in that number. The fragments in Field's edition of Origins, Hexapla, attest to only two words of the Hebrew of this verse, and the way in which they were read in other translations. But the meaning expressed in the Septuagint is also the meaning interpreted from Hebrew in the New American Standard Bible, although that edition adds words in order to fill in the sense of what is being said here. Here Moses had exhorted Yahweh to choose some other man for this mission, and the exhortation is depicted as having provoked the wrath of God in verse 14, Exodus chapter 4. And the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Moses. And he said, Is not Aaron the Levite thy brother? I know that he could speak well. And also, behold, he comes forth to meet thee. And when he sees thee, he will be glad in his heart. So Aaron may have already been told to go meet Moses. We'll discuss that at length, briefly. And thou shalt speak unto him, and put words in his mouth, and I will be with thy mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you what you shall do. And he shall be thy spokesman unto the people, and he shall be, even he shall be to thee instead of a mouth, and thou shalt be to him instead of God. And thou shalt take this rod in thine hand, wherewith thou shalt do signs. In other words, Aaron would obey Moses as Moses, as Aaron would obey God, but Moses is the chosen intermediary here. Aaron does not talk to God directly. Yahweh God, throughout the entire Exodus account, only deals with Moses, who passes things to Aaron. As we had discussed in reference to the earlier chapters of Exodus, Miriam seems to have been the oldest child, and she was apparently the sister of Moses who, as a young girl, was able to speak to the daughter of Pharaoh when Moses was discovered in the basket of reeds. And Aaron was 3 years older than Moses, so he was evidently born before the orders for the Hebrews to expose their male children were harshly enforced, or possibly even before they had been issued. So the dialogue here also indicates that Moses had indeed known something about his natural family in Egypt, in spite of his having been raised in the house of Pharaoh. So Moses is compelled to relent and accept his appointment, even if he seemed so reluctant that Yahweh had become angry with him. And then we read in verse 18, Exodus chapter 4, and Moses went and returned to Jethro. His father-in-law, and said unto him, let me go, I pray thee, and return unto my brethren which are in Egypt, and see whether they be yet alive. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. And Yahweh said unto Moses in Midian, go, return to Egypt, for all the men are dead which sought thy life. And that Moses going to Jethro and asking for permission to leave, that's a lot like Jacob, the relationship between Jacob and Laban five generations before this, where Jacob submitted himself to Laban. He was in Laban's home serving Laban and subjected himself to Laban all that time, even when he was treated unfairly. So Moses, that must have been the custom at a time of the time when you're in your father-in-law's house, or especially in your father's house, you should be subject to your father or your father-in-law. It's the Moses was there under basically under compulsion because he was fleeing from Egypt and brought no cash, no money. He'd ended up a slave if it wasn't for the goodness of Jethro. That's very possible. Okay, at the end of our recent Genesis commentary, we had appended a post-Genesis chronology, and we had probably also discussed the chronology of Exodus elsewhere. So we shall only summarize it here. According to our Genesis chronology, Moses was born approximately, and there's links to it in the text, Moses was born approximately 1530 BC. This is deducted from his age in the event of the Exodus, where we read in Exodus chapter 7, and I will get this far this evening, but I didn't think so when I wrote this. And Moses was 80 years old, and Aaron 83 years old when they spoke unto Pharaoh. In that same chronology, we set an approximate date for the Exodus of 1450 BC, which we deduced in part by counting the lives and birth years of the patriarchs down through Abraham, the age of Abraham at his calling by Yahweh, and then from the statement of Paul of Tarsus, who stated in chapter 3 of his epistle to the Galatians that it was 430 years from the call of Abraham to the giving of the law at Sinai. That's sort of repeated here in the book of Exodus in chapters to do with the Exodus event itself, but it's not exact because it just says in Egypt, it doesn't give that entire span. And if we, well, we did make sense of that in our chronology, that the 430 years, Paul must be correct about that, that it had to go from the call of Abraham to the Exodus. Otherwise, the dates are all skewed with history, and it won't work. Okay, that's why denominational Christians have such a problem, and they can't prove the presence of Israel in Egypt over 400 years, but Israel in Egypt was actually only in bondage for a portion of half that time, perhaps. I estimated it earlier, but I forget the duration, perhaps 150 years, and that's it. Okay. That they were actually in bondage in Egypt. It is evident in our Genesis chronology that all of these dates agree with other witnesses, such as the time of the lives of Isaac and Jacob, down to when Jacob had gone to Egypt. That is also fairly consistent with the statement of Paul in Acts chapter 13, that it was 450 years that Israel had been ruled by judges up to the time of Samuel the prophet. So once we get into the historical period, from that time, we see that our chronology is approximately consistent with ancient history, including that of Egypt and Assyria, even if there are small differences at various times. For example, we had explained in our Genesis and Isaiah commentaries that there is a 10-year problem reconciling the histories of Israel and Assyria, which is naggingly persistent throughout the entire period of Assyrian intervention in Israel and Judah. But with all that being said, Moses was 40 years old when he fled Egypt, having been born around 1530 BC, according to our chronology. The Pharaoh from whom he had fled was most likely Thutmose II, who, by the common Egyptian chronology, is said to have ruled Egypt from 1493 to 1479 BC. This Thutmose was succeeded by his wife, Hatshepsut, who was both queen and regent for his successor, Thutmose III, as he was too young to directly replace his father when he had died. During his early life, Hatshepsut consolidated her power, and Thutmose III, although he was a son by another of his father's wives, had evidently remained more or less subordinate to her until her death in 1458 BC. But the rule of Thutmose III is generally counted as having been concurrent from 1479 to 1425 BC. And with that, it is quite certain that he was the Pharaoh of the Exodus account. In several passages of his treatise against Appian, Flavius Josephus, following the earlier Egyptian writer Manetho, attested that Thutmose was the Pharaoh of the Exodus, but he does not state which Thutmose. I believe there were four of them, four kings using that name. So where Yahweh had told Moses here in Exodus chapter 4, that all the men are dead which sought thy life, this Thutmose III would have had little or no connection to the reign of his father at the time of the flight of Moses, as his age is estimated to have been as young as 2 years when his father had died, although his date of birth is uncertain and he may have been a little older. Even Hatshepsut, who is estimated to have been born as early as 1505 BC or as late as 1495 BC, even she was very young as Moses fled Egypt. So at most, she could have been 14 or 15 years old at the flight of Moses, or as young as 4 or 5 years old. However, it is possible that she had been familiar with Moses as a young girl, since she was the half-sister of her husband Thutmose II. They were keeping it all in the family at this time. They were each the children of Pharaoh Thutmose I, and they had different mothers. The chronology of the 18th dynasty pharaohs before the time of Thutmose I has difficulties, But his paternal grandfather, Amos I, seems to be the best candidate for the pharaoh at the time of the birth of Moses. He had at least 3 daughters and 4 sons, so we don't know which one of those daughters was the princess. But Hatshepsut wouldn't be born for at least another 25 years after Moses, and possibly 35 years. So a lot of commentators, and I believe this includes Clifton Emmaheiser in some of his early papers, and I had been persuaded by Clifton at one time, but I haven't now for many years. A lot of commentators claim that Hatshepsut was the princess that found Moses and pulled him out of the water, and that's not true. It happened at least a generation before her time. She wasn't born until 25 years at least, or possibly 35 years after Moses was born. And that's quite certain. So circumstantially, not only is it evident in that statement that the men who sought the life of Moses were all dead, but the rulers at the time of his return to Egypt, 40 years after his flight, would have been too young to have even remembered him. At most, the name of Moses may have been a distant and dim memory, if he was not altogether forgotten. So a reluctant Moses, who was already off on a bad footing with the God whom he would serve for the rest of his life, is portrayed as packing up his wife Zipporah and the 2 sons whom he had with her and setting out for Egypt. Along the way, Moses begins to receive instruction. And the instructions must have been beyond what we read here, as we will find out later. And Yahweh said unto Moses, "When thou goest to return to Egypt, see that thou do all those wonders before Pharaoh, which I have put in thine hand." Well, we haven't really been told a whole lot yet. So Moses must have been told things which aren't recorded here. "But I will harden his heart, that he shall not let the people go." Moses was later discouraged anyway, in spite of this warning. "And thou shalt say unto Pharaoh, Thus saith Yahweh, Israel is my son, even my firstborn. And I say unto thee, Let my son go, that he may serve me. And if thou refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay thy son, even thy firstborn." So the event of the killing of the firstborn of the Egyptians is the first of the plagues that Yahweh had planned upon Egypt, even if it was not first in order when the plagues were actually inflicted. It's actually last in order, or next to last, if you want to count the loss of the Egyptian army in the Red Sea. But now there is an episode of personal drama in the life of Moses. In verse 24, we're still in Exodus chapter 4. "And it came to pass, by the way, in the inn," and that's important to note that Moses is in an inn here, and the reasons for that will become evident later. "It came to pass, by the way, in the inn that Yahweh met him and sought to kill him. Then Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at his feet, and said, Surely a bloody husband thou art to me. So he let him go. Then she said, A bloody husband thou art because of the circumcision." And this passage, it's written so concisely. This passage raises several questions, but it certainly seems to be an authentic part of the text. So first, according to the Dead Sea Scrolls Study Bible by Abeg, Flint, and Ulrich, while most of the chapter from verses 9 through 26 are completely wanting, they're missing, the scrolls disintegrate, sufficient fragments of the text of verses 26 and 27 had survived, to understand that these verses did appear in the manuscripts of the scrolls. So while this account of Moses and the circumcision of his son by his wife Zipporah seems out of place here, it is attested to some degree in the manuscripts of the Dead Sea Scrolls. The verses are also attested in Hebrew and Old Latin, as well as the Septuagint and the other later Greek translations in Origen's Hexapla. So we can't challenge the veracity of the verses. I'm sorry. I have a dry cough and it's terrible. I've been trying to mute myself. You notice little gaps in the time. That time I didn't get a chance and my voice is getting froggy or raspy, I should say, would be better. Circumcision was practiced in ancient Egypt. And I'm drinking tea, but it's not helping. It was practiced especially by the upper classes of the Egyptians. Moses was raised in the house of the king. He was raised as a prince. But it was only a matter of custom and not as a matter of law. There is archaeological evidence of the practice there, which dates to as early as the 6th dynasty and the 23rd century BC. That's over 300 years before Abraham was born. But was circumcision being practiced among the Israelites at this time? In Exodus chapter 12, it is stated that strangers must be circumcised in order to eat the Passover. And it states that no uncircumcised person shall eat thereof. But there is not an explicit record of a mass circumcision at this time. So we would be led to believe that the Israelites had maintained the practice of circumcision in Egypt, except for a statement in the book of Joshua. So whether they maintained circumcision in Egypt or whether there was a mass circumcision before the first Passover, which is not recorded, sometime later, in the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, the practice evidently ceased. And once those years were completed, we read in Joshua chapter 5 from verse 2. At that time, Yahweh said unto Joshua, make these sharp knives and circumcise again the children of Israel the second time. And of course, that's the line which makes me suspect there was a mass circumcision before that first Passover, because it says circumcise them again the second time. And Joshua made him sharp knives and circumcised the children of Israel at the hill of foreskins. And this is the cause why Joshua did circumcise. All the people that came out of Egypt that were males, even all the men of war, died in the wilderness by the way after they came out of Egypt. They were in the wilderness for over 40 years. Now all the people that came out were circumcised. But all the people that were born in the wilderness, by the way, as they came forth out of Egypt, them they had not circumcised. So there you have it. They stopped the circumcision rite in the wilderness. So where it says the second time, that implies that there was a mass circumcision before the first Passover, even if Moses did not record one. So we cannot be entirely certain for the motive for circumcision here in Exodus chapter 5, but it seems that Yahweh may have commanded it of Moses in order to have Moses rectify his own house before he entered Egypt. So we may ask, were Moses and Zipporah bickering because Moses wanted to circumcise his son before taking him to Egypt? And if so, why weren't both sons mentioned as having been circumcised? When Moses packed Zipporah up, he took both his sons with him to Egypt. Those sons couldn't be young boys. They weren't young boys. Moses was in the land of Midian for 40 years. And according to the account, when he got to Midian, he married Zipporah rather early in his sojourn in Midian. Actually, like, real quick. As soon as he got there, he was feeding her cattle, and he met her father, and her father gave her to him. So that was probably within weeks. So Moses has been married to Zipporah for like 40 years. Zipporah didn't take a child and circumcise him. She took a grown man, her son, and circumcised him. So did Yahweh have an issue with Moses because the sons were not circumcised? If at least many of the Israelites in captivity in Egypt may not have been circumcised. Perhaps it would not matter whether the Israelites were circumcised, because Moses was to be their leader, and therefore he should have also been a role model for him, for them. So he was circumcised, and Yahweh wanted his sons to be circumcised also as a model for the Israelites. The concise nature of this account leaves open these questions and probably others, but I believe that we can answer them at the same time as we've been doing. In any event, Zipporah evidently circumcised her son in response to the trial suffered by Moses. And on account of that, she had enmity towards him. So it seems that he had insisted on the circumcision. And it seems that circumcision must have been an issue between them before that point. In the Septuagint, it is the angel of the Lord whom Moses encountered at the inn. But the later Greek translations of Aquila, of Sinope, Symmachus, and Theodotion all agree with the Masoretic text that Yahweh met Moses at the inn. So Zipporah, having been a Midianite, seems hostile to the concept of circumcision. And by that we know that the practice was alien to the children of Midian. Abraham had circumcised both Ishmael and Isaac in Genesis chapter 17, but there is no record of his having circumcised his later sons with Keturah. I believe their birth is announced in Genesis chapter 25. I'm sure. What is more evident, however, is that here Moses had been appointed to lead the household of Yahweh out of Egypt. But if Moses cannot assert his authority over his own private household, then how does he qualify to rule the house of Israel? Therefore, it becomes apparent that he suffered this trial so that he may learn to step up and assert his patriarchal authority when it is necessary, so that he would not falter and vacillate to a headstrong woman who would attempt to supplant his authority, as it is evident that Zipporah had defied him here. Paul of Tarsus had written of this necessity in 1 Timothy chapter 3. A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality, apt to teach, not given to wine, no striker, not greedy of filthy lucre, but patient, not a brawler, not covetous, one that rules well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For a man, if a man knows not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? And the children of Israel are the church of God. Therefore, Moses had to be compelled to rule his own house so that he would be prepared to rule over the house of God. in the opening verses of Hebrews chapter 3. Paul of Tarsus wrote concerning Moses and his relationship with the household of Yahweh. Wherefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider the apostle and the high priest of our profession, Christ Jesus, who is faithful to him that appointed him, as also Moses was faithful in all his house. Paul didn't mention the incident at the inn. For this man, Christ, this man was counted worthy of more glory than Moses, inasmuch as he who has builded the house, meaning Christ, has more honor than the house of which Moses was a part. For every house is built by some man, but he that built all things is God, which is Christ. And Moses, verily, was faithful in all his house as a servant for testimony of those things which were to be spoken after. But Christ as a son over his own house, because he's God, whose house we are, if we hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm to the end. Of course, Yahweh God knows each turn of future events long before they transpire. So what is described next did not necessarily happen subsequent to what has already been described. So we shall read the closing verses of Exodus chapter 4. What I'm trying to say in so many words is that this instruction may have already been sent to Aaron, because Yahweh had told Moses earlier that Aaron's coming to meet you. And Yahweh said to Aaron, go into the wilderness to meet Moses. And he went and met him in the mount of God and kissed him. Now, this is very important. Moses was on an inn on the way to Egypt, and he met Aaron later, after the inn, in the mount of God, which is Sinai. And he kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of Yahweh who had sent him, and all the signs which he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel. And Aaron spoke all the words which Yahweh had spoken to Moses, and did the signs in the sight of the people. And the people believed. And when they heard that Yahweh had visited the children of Israel, and that he looked upon their afflictions, then they bowed their heads and worshipped. As Yahweh had promised Moses, the crooked paths were made straight so that the people believed him. Yet Aaron must have been a respected elder among the Israelites in the captivity, although he was the eldest of the male line descended from Levi's second son, Kohath. The people would have been familiar with Aaron, while Moses was but a stranger to them. As for the mountain of God, the label may indeed have been used anachronistically here, since Moses had most likely written this account sometime, perhaps even some years, after these events had taken place. Wherever the children of Israel had crossed the Red Sea, they had done so only a short time after their departure from Goshen. They departed on the day of the Passover, in Exodus chapter 13, and they encamped in Sukkoth, in verse 37 of that chapter. But there is no record of any intervening days, nor is there any record of events that must have spanned more than a day. And the last verse in chapter 12 informs us that it was still the same day in which they had departed. I'm sorry, the last verse of chapter 13. I believe. I better double check that while I'm here. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I have editing problems. The last verse of chapter 12. So I must have referred to chapter 13 by error a little earlier in that paragraph. I'm sorry. I can screw up. I do it all the time. Ramses to Sukkoth, verse 37. Should be chapter 12, verse 37. And I wrote 13 yesterday. I think I did that part yesterday. Maybe this morning. Okay. They departed on the day of Passover in Exodus chapter 12, not 13, and he encamped at Sukkoth in verse 37. But there is no record of any intervening days. And the last verse in chapter 12 informs us that it was still the day in which they had departed, and they were camping in Sukkoth. As chapter 13 opens, it is still the same day, and some commandments are given concerning the Passover and the firstborn of beasts. However, no further time seems to have passed before we read at the end of chapter 13 that the children of Israel departed from Sukkoth and camped at Eltham at the edge of the wilderness. Then, with no records of any activity at Eltham, as Exodus chapter 14 opens, Moses is told, "Speak unto the children of Israel that they turn and encamp before Pi-hahiroth, between Migdal and the sea, over against Baal-zephon. Before it ye shall encamp by the sea." So it is very likely that the children of Israel encamped in Sukkoth the first night, Eltham the second, and Pi-hahiroth on the third night after departing from Pi-Ramses. And in the manner in which the account is written, there is no reason to believe it had been any longer. So it seems highly likely that the Exodus crossing of the Red Sea had occurred on the fourth day. In the ancient world, traveling on foot with a large contingent of people, it is highly unlikely that they could have covered more than 25 miles in a day, and that distance would be difficult. But they were departing in hurried circumstances. We don't know where any of these locations of these towns are, except Pi-Ramses. That was a famous city, and it's been excavated by archaeologists. That's how we know. Lots of statues of Ramses, I gather. I'm joking. But Baal-zephon, Pi-hahiroth, Migdal, all of these places, we don't know where they were. There are some that are claimed to be in particular areas. Pi-hahiroth is claimed to be right on the sea, perhaps 200 miles south of where we would expect it to be after only a three-day journey. But it was supposed to be right on the sea. It's marked as being right on the sea. It's on Google Maps. But Pi-hahiroth doesn't seem to be right on the sea according to this description. That's arguable. Okay, it's between Migdal and the sea, wherever Migdal was. I believe that word just means tower. Okay. Traveling with a large contingent of people on foot, 25 miles a day would be a very good distance to travel. Roman armies were expected to keep that pace, I believe, and these are highly trained men in Roman armies, where here we have a motley group of women, children, and perhaps a lot of elderly men that just aren't going to move so fast. From the ancient site of Pi-Ramses, there's a resort town on the Red Sea, which is called Ain Sakhna. And that is about 80 miles distant by air. I had to pick a spot just to give us an idea of the distance. So with some travel, on the fourth day of their journey, that is probably close to the furthest point south at which the children of Israel could have crossed the Red Sea. And I will have maps accompanying this when it's posted, this presentation when it's posted, there'll be maps in a text. This is in the northern portion of the Gulf of Suez. Very close to the very northern portion. Crossing at that point, there is full agreement with the geography of Sinai, where they had emerged from the sea, as we read in Exodus chapter 15. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. The wilderness of Shur, by all accounts, is the strip of desert adjacent to ancient Egypt, north of the Gulf of Suez. And that is consistent with the 6 passages in which it is mentioned in Scripture. The children of Israel did not begin to grow weary from their travels and their time in the desert until after they had crossed the Red Sea. And they finally reached Sinai about a month after the first Passover, which was the day that they departed from Egypt. However, there they had tarried in several places, and that does not mean that Sinai was not relatively close to begin with. Well, we hope to discuss all of this in greater detail when we reach the appropriate chapters of Exodus. We only intend to show here that the Exodus crossing could not have occurred at any point in the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula. In our opinion, the best candidate for identification with Sinai, and is actually at least one historical tourist marker on Google Maps that marks this place as Sinai. You got to look for it, though. It's not that easy to find on Google Maps. In our opinion, the best candidate is a mountainous cluster which lies between 4 modern Egyptian towns, Bir Hama, Bir al-Jifjafa, Bir af-Famala, and Bir Hassana. And each of these towns is named Bir. It's named for a particular well or spring, like Bir Sheba means the well of Sheba. Bir Hama means the well of Hama, or maybe the spring of Hama. That's the same. It's spelled differently in Arabic, but it's the same word as the Hebrew, basically. This site, this mountainous cluster, this site would be just slightly more than 100 miles east of Pi Ramses. So that Aaron may make the journey to meet Moses in about 4 days, or faster if he had access to a chariot, which is not unreasonable. But in any event, this advanced meeting with Moses helps to establish the fact that the mountain of God, which is a label for Mount Sinai, must have been somewhere along the route which was commonly traveled between the land of Midian and the conventional entrances into Egypt, the trade routes. Moses was traveling to Egypt casually with his family and had no reason at all to venture into the mountains of South Sinai. The southern portion of the Sinai Peninsula is very sparsely inhabited, with only a handful of small towns, even on its coasts. There might be like 6 or 8 towns down there, and there's an airport all the way at the bottom. Don't ask me why, because it's nowhere to go, unless there's some resorts or something. I didn't zoom in on every portion of the coast, but there's only 6 or 8 towns in the entire bottom portion of Sinai. And the mountains, that most of the towns are on the seas, that on the Gulf of Aqaba on one side or on the Gulf of Suez on the other. And there's hardly anything in the middle. It's rough, inhospitable, high mountainous terrain. Moses, going from Midian to Egypt, had no reason to go down there. He's making a casual, I say, because it's not an ordered march. He's making a casual trip to Egypt with his family, probably has a wagon and his wife and 2 sons and their belongings, or at least what they felt was important to take. So he's just going to Egypt, and he's on the customary routes to Egypt and meets Aaron at the mountain of God. He was told he'd meet Aaron. Where he was told he would meet Aaron in Exodus, it didn't tell us where he would meet Aaron, but perhaps he knew, but he had no reason to go all the way, or Aaron also had no reason to go all the way into the mountains in the southern portion of the Sinai Peninsula. The Exodus route and the Sinai of the Exodus must have been in the north, and they must have been along or accessible from the regular trade routes traveled between Midian and Egypt, period. And this meeting demonstrates that fully. And to hell with all these other Bible clown denominational commentators that say otherwise. They are all blowing smoke out their asses. Okay, my rant. Now we shall move on to Exodus chapter 5. And it seems that almost immediately after arriving in Egypt, Moses has his first confrontation with the Pharaoh. It may have been days or whatever, but the way the account's written, it's like he just got off his wagon. No, I'm kind of half kidding. And afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, "Thus saith Yahweh, God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast unto me in the wilderness." And Pharaoh said, "Who is Yahweh that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I know not Yahweh, neither will I let Israel go." And they said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Let us go, we pray thee, 3 days journey into the desert and sacrifice unto Yahweh our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword." And the king of Egypt said unto them, "Wherefore do you, Moses and Aaron, let the people from their works? Get you unto your burdens." In the treaties of the ancient world, and we demonstrated this several times in the Genesis commentary, especially in treaties with the Hittites. In the treaties of this ancient world, the kings of nations often invoked the names of the gods of the surrounding nations. This is especially evident in the treaties of the Hittites and Egyptians, or the treaties of the Hittites and the Amorites, which had been made around this very same time in history. Check out the treaties of Mersilla in the Genesis commentary. If you could spell that, you could search for it and find it. The names of the gods of the nations would be invoked so that those who would violate the treaties would be punished accordingly. But in response to Moses' having invoked the name of Yahweh, this Pharaoh said, "Who is Yahweh that I should obey his voice to let Israel go?" If the name of Yahweh had been associated with any god in Canaan or Syria at this time, this Pharaoh would have known that, because he ruled over a great portion of the lands of Canaan and Syria. During the time of Thutmose III, Egypt was at its greatest height, its zenith, the zenith of its overseas possessions and the zenith of its power. So the customs and circumstances of the time helped serve to destroy the contentions of the critics who claimed that the name of Yahweh is older than the time of Moses. This pharaoh was highly educated in all of the customs of the surrounding nations, and his response makes it evident that he had never heard the name before this time. While we do not know much about the personal disposition of this pharaoh, Thutmose III, he seems here to be a very harsh ruler, especially over his slaves. But this Thutmose had apparently had every reason to have been a very proud man. Typical of characterizations of his reign is the Wikipedia entry for him, and I have a link here in a text, which states that in part he is sometimes called Thutmose the Great, ostensibly by modern historians at least, and that he is regarded as one of the greatest warriors, military commanders, and military strategists of his time as Egypt's preeminent warrior, pharaoh, and conqueror, and as a dominant figure in the New Kingdom period. It is said that he led from 17 to 20, they're not sure, I guess, military campaigns, and he was undefeated, and that he innovated, for example, forming an Egyptian navy, which is the first known state navy in the ancient world. He actually was smart enough to spare his troops long marches before battles by sending his troops on boats into northern Syria, having them land there and going to the point of the battle. This year being 1450 BC, he had already ruled Egypt for 29 years, including the period of co-regency, which he had alongside Hatshepsut, and much of that time was spent generaling the Egyptian armies. Generaling, I should say, like commanding, may not be so tongue-twisting. Okay. Therefore, rather than giving the people any rest from their labors, he makes it much harder for them to complete their assignments. And Pharaoh said, "Behold, the people of the land now are many, and you make them rest from their burdens." And Pharaoh commanded the same day the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, "You shall no more give the people straw to make brick, as heretofore. Let them go and gather straw for themselves, and the tale or tally of the bricks, which they did make heretofore, you shall lay upon them. You shall not diminish aught thereof, for they be idle. Therefore they cry, saying, 'Let us go and sacrifice to our God.' Let their more work be laid upon the men, that they may labor therein, and let them not regard vain words." In the subsequent verses, the Egyptian taskmasters bring this message to the children of Israel, and when they cannot fulfill the demands, they beat the Israelites, whom they had appointed over their brethren to supervise their work. So on that account, these supervisors go to Moses and Aaron, and in the last two verses of chapter 5, we read, "And they met Moses and Aaron, who stood in the way. as they came forth from Pharaoh. And they said unto them, Yahweh looks upon you and judges, because you have made our savor to be abhorred in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to slay us. And Moses returned to Yahweh and said, Lord, wherefore hast thou so evil entreated this people? Why is it that thou hast sent me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in thy name, he has done evil to this people, neither hast thou delivered thy people at all. So Moses is upset with God, but Moses had been warned. There is an old adage that the night is always darkest before the dawn, and in many circumstances it is absolutely true, this being one of them. But just like modern Christians, who are enslaved by modern pharaohs in his current world tyranny, which the scripture refers to as Mystery Babylon, the ancient Israelites in Egypt were comfortable in their state of oppression, so they could not tolerate any further adversity, even if it would lead to the release from bondage. Later, in the wilderness, they lamented and expressed a desire to return to bondage in Egypt, rather than face the hardships they suffered there. Now, as we proceed with Exodus chapter 6, Moses has an answer from Yahweh regarding this situation caused by their first confrontation with Pharaoh. Then Yahweh said unto Moses, Now shalt thou see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand shall he let them go, and with a strong hand shall he drive them out of his land. And God spoke unto Moses and said unto him, I am Yahweh, and I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob, by the name of God Almighty. But by my name, and this is the King James Version, by my name Jehovah was I not known to them. I have also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, wherein they were strangers. Here Yahweh is invoking the covenants which he made with the fathers as an assurance to Moses, that he would also do what he has promised to do here. Where we see the word Jehovah, the name, I should say, Jehovah. This is an anglicized version of the alternate translation which we had offered, the alternate transliteration, I should say, which we had offered for Yahweh. And I would say that it's a legitimate transliteration, but it's not a correct one. This transliteration, Yod-Heh-Vau-Heh, which we pronounce as Yahweh, may be pronounced as Jehovah. We stop short of explaining that since there is an alternate form of the verb meaning to be, which is Hava, then using that spelling, Jehovah is a legitimate transliteration of the name of Yahweh. This we said in our discussion of Exodus chapter 3, referring to the Brown Driver Briggs definition of the term. At the beginning of their definition, we said, they explained that Haya, Hey, Yod, Hey, is a parallel form of Hawa or Hava, which is Hey, Vav, Hey. And of course, the Vav, the Hebrew letter Vav, may be a Wa or a Vav, a W or a V. So if to be can be spelled as Hey Vav Hey, which is HVH or HWH, Hawa or Hava, then he is maybe spelled as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh or Yahweh-Wah-Heh, Yahweh or Yahweh, depending on how you want to say it. But that may also be transliterated as Yehovah or perhaps Yehovah, as the original form of the verb is transliterated as Hawa or Hava. So put a yod in front of that, in front of Hava, and you have Yahovah or Yahava, but that's Jehovah. This is the real source of the alternate spelling of the name of Yahweh as Jehovah. The story about the monks, I don't know who made that up, that vowels for Adonai were added to consonants for Yahweh. I don't believe that. I may have repeated that early in my writing, but I don't think so. But I don't believe it, and I haven't believed it in quite a while. Okay. I kind of always doubted it for some reason. I don't know. Or at least always over the last 5 or 10 years. It's only the last few years that I've had the opportunity to study as much Hebrew as I have. I think since I started the Genesis commentary, I began to look at Hebrew and spend a lot more time with it. I've always kind of resisted that because Jews are the source for all of the contemporary understanding for Hebrew, and Jews speak Yiddish, and they're full of, well, they're lying, let's put it that way. They're lying about a lot of things. So I've kind of been doing this independently on my own, and I'm much better off. Okay. In Genesis chapter 15, Yahweh had promised to give to Abraham all the land of Canaan. So that promise is repeated here, that it would be fulfilled in Israel once they depart from Egypt. Continuing with Exodus chapter 6. And I've also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage. And I've remembered my covenant, the ones he made with Abraham. Wherefore say unto the children of Israel, I am Yahweh, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and will rid you out of their bondage. And I will redeem you with a stretched out arm and with great judgments, and I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you for a God. And you shall know that I am Yahweh your God, which brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And I will bring you into the land concerning the which I did swear to Abraham, to give it to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, and I will give it to you for a heritage. I am Yahweh. And these are great promises considering their current state of bondage. But the children of Israel seem to have been angry that they were moved from their comfort level and might have to suffer somewhat while these things are brought to fruition. And Moses spoke unto the children of Israel, but they hearkened not unto Moses for anguish of spirit and for cruel bondage. People today seem to be no different, as they would give up every liberty they have for a pint of beer and football. But Moses once again becomes recalcitrant and expresses doubt in verse 10. Exodus chapter 6. And Yahweh spoke unto Moses, saying, go in, speak unto the Pharaoh, king of Egypt, that he let the children of Israel go out of his land. And Moses spoke before Yahweh, saying, behold, the children of Israel have not hearkened unto me. How then shall Pharaoh hear me, who am of uncircumcised lips? The objections which Moses had seem to have been ignored. Verse 13. And Yahweh spoke unto Moses and unto Aaron, and gave them a charge unto the children of Israel and unto Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. And at this point in Exodus chapter 6, there was a reckoning of the principal families of Israel, but it only mentions three tribes, the three eldest of the sons of Jacob, which are Reuben, Simeon, and Levi. Then most of the Israelites who are listed cannot be alive at this point of history, because only one generation of the sons of Reuben and Simeon are mentioned. But two generations of the sons of Levi through his sons Gershon and Merari. None of these can be alive at this point. Then through his son Kohath, at least three generations are listed for each of his sons, with the exception of Amram, where a fourth is listed, being Moses and Aaron. And they're quite old. They're 80 years old. And a fifth generation in the children of Aaron. But the sons of Moses are not listed. So the purpose of this listing is obscure, because it seems odd to mention the sons of Reuben and Simeon, who were basically left nothing for inheritance when their father Jacob had blessed his sons. And not to mention, or I should say, but not to mention the other nine sons and their tribes. The real purpose seems to be to list the genealogy of Levi down to the sons of Aaron, who would have the priesthood. But they do not have the priesthood yet at this point, and the entire list seems out of place. Well, the text of the Dead Sea Scrolls here is fragmentary. It does support the general reading of the Masoretic text. So I can't say that these passages don't belong here. I just think that it's strange, especially that only three tribes were mentioned, and the first two of them, well, it was 215 years that the children of Israel were in Egypt. And at least most of the sons of Reuben and Simeon were already born. So they didn't live 215 years. No. Sorry. No way. Men were living about 130 to 140 years at this time, as we shall see. I think I discussed that briefly. Now some things from earlier in this chapter are repeated in the closing verses. So not only do we have this weird digression for this partial genealogy of three tribes, but now we're going to repeat some of the things that we saw earlier in the chapter before that genealogy. These are that Moses and Aaron, to whom Yahweh said, bring out the children of Israel from the land of Egypt according to their armies. Now that line there belongs with the end of that genealogy, but I thought I should repeat that. These are they which spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring out the children of Israel from Egypt. These are that Moses and Aaron. And it came to pass on the day when Yahweh spoke unto Moses in the land of Egypt, that Yahweh spoke unto Moses, saying, I am Yahweh. Speak thou unto Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say unto thee. And Moses said before Yahweh, behold, I am of uncircumcised lips, and how shall Pharaoh hearken unto me? As chapter 7 opens, Moses is answered, but his protest is once again ignored without reprimand. The confrontation heightens as they confront the Pharaoh once again, and we shall read the opening verses of the chapter. And Yahweh said unto Moses, see, I have made thee a god to Pharaoh, and Aaron thy brother shall be thy prophet. Thou shalt speak all that I command thee, and Aaron thy brother shall speak unto Pharaoh, that he send the children of Israel out of his land. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. But Pharaoh shall not hearken unto you, that I may lay my hand upon Egypt and bring forth mine armies and my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great judgments. Moses had been warned in Exodus chapter 4 before the first confrontation with Pharaoh that the Pharaoh would not let the people go, where we read, and Yahweh said unto Moses, when thou goest to return into Egypt, see that thou do all these wonders before Pharaoh, which I have put in thine hand, but I will harden his heart that he shall not let the people go. Yet Moses still became discouraged when he confronted Pharaoh, and Pharaoh didn't listen. He was told that Pharaoh wouldn't listen, but he was discouraged that Pharaoh didn't listen. Instead, Moses should have become encouraged because the outcome was precisely what he had been told it would be. But eventually, as we proceed through the plagues of Egypt, it seems that Moses does finally cease from being discouraged. For now, we shall continue through the second confrontation with the Pharaoh. Verse 5, Exodus chapter 7. And the Egyptians shall know that I am Yahweh, when I stretch forth mine hand upon Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them. And Moses and Aaron did as Yahweh commanded them, so did they. Now, right there, it should be no surprise that 50 or 60 years later, Amenhotep III, the Pharaoh of Egypt, mentioned the Shasu of Yahweh in his inscriptions. Here Yahweh says, and the Egyptians shall know that I am Yahweh when I stretch forth my hand upon Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them. So it's not a surprise that Amenhotep III knew that name and used it in inscriptions. None whatsoever. Okay. For some unknown reason, Moses takes this opportunity to relate the ages of himself and Aaron before proceeding with further instructions by describing, I should say, further instructions from Yahweh. So we read in verse 7, and Moses was 80 years old, and Aaron 83 years old when he spoke unto Pharaoh. And Yahweh spoke unto Moses and unto Aaron, saying, when Pharaoh shall speak unto you, saying, show a miracle for you, then thou shalt say unto Aaron, take thy rod and cast it before Pharaoh, and it shall become a serpent. Moses was 80 years old, but in those days men were still living somewhat longer lifespans than they have historically. For example, according to Exodus chapter 6, the part we kind of skipped over, verses 18 through 20. Kohath, the grandfather of Moses, had lived for 133 years, and Amram, his father, lived even longer, for 137 years. So the son of Kohath lived longer than Kohath. I think Joseph only lived 110 years. Now there is a second short confrontation with the Pharaoh. And Moses and Aaron went in unto Pharaoh, and they did so as Yahweh had commanded. And Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh and before his servants, and it became a serpent. Then Pharaoh also called the wise men and the sorcerers, now the magicians of Egypt. They also did in like manner with their enchantments, for they cast down every man his rod, and they became serpents. But Aaron's rod swallowed up their rods, and he hardened Pharaoh's heart, that he hearkened not unto them as Yahweh had said, as we shall see when we discuss the plagues of Egypt. Yahweh had punished the Egyptians with their own devices. This is described in reference to Egypt in the Wisdom of Solomon, and we shall elucidate that here in reference to the plagues which had come upon Egypt as we proceed with this portion of Exodus. For now, we could note that the serpent In Egyptian mythology, it was a foreboding sign, the serpent in the sky that had attempted to swallow the bark or the boat of Ra every night and was defeated by Seth. That's how the Egyptians saw the sunset, as Ra passing around to the netherworld and the serpent constellation Draco attacking him and Seth defeating the serpent. It's been a long time since I spoke about that, but I spoke about it at length and the symbology behind it in the closing few presentations in my Pragmatic Genesis series 12 or 13 years ago. Okay. So the serpent was also the symbol of royalty, of kingship in Egypt and in other nations in Mesopotamia. The pharaohs wore that serpent on the front of their headdresses to symbolize their authority, that their authority came from a serpent. And we should understand the implications of that. So I think that's kind of funny. So the serpent, Yahweh punishes the Egyptians with their own devices. And that serpent did have a lot of meaning in the cultural life of Egypt. So with that, it is also evident that the trick of turning a staff into a serpent must have been previously practiced by the Egyptian magicians, for which reason Yahweh had chosen to make an exhibition here. In the later plagues, the magicians themselves confessed to the Pharaoh that he should concede to the God of Moses. But the Pharaoh continues to be hardened in heart. He doesn't even listen to his own magicians. All of this is purposed towards a glorious destruction of Egypt. And at that point, we hope to return soon when we can continue our highlights in Exodus. Thank you for listening. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and good night.